This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
It's my pleasure this morning to introduce someone who really needs no introduction because we have heard of him many times, but a good friend of Cavendish who is rather accomplished, makes guys like me feel rather underaccomplished. But Dr. Scott Parazynski is a physician, a pilot, a five-time space shuttle astronaut, climbed Everest, summited Everest twice, I believe.
Once.
Just once. One time you couldn't do it because you had to rescue a Sherpa or something.
I had to rescue myself.
Ah, okay. he's traveled all over the world. He's recently become a university explorer and professor of practice at the Arizona State University. He's a prolific inventor and innovator. He serves on the boards of a number of companies and organizations. And in his spare time, he always joins us at Cavendish. I'm very pleased and proud to welcome Dr. Scott Parazynski.
Thank you so much. It's a real thrill to be back with the Cavendish family. I really do feel that this is a special collection of people with a real passion for making a difference in the world. It's not just about our return on investment, but return on benefit to humanity. And so I feel this is a really special DNA that all of us share. It's been a wonderful conference. Starting out, we arrived Tuesday and enjoyed Peter Samuelson's very passionate talk, and all the talks since then have been really fantastic. So thank you for inviting me back. I did want to take this opportunity to recognize a couple of very, very special people here in the audience. My breathtaking and brilliant wife, Minnie Wadhwa, is here with me, and then also Dr. Alan Hargens, who is a long-standing friend and mentor, one of the most creative scientists on the planet. And I say that not to suggest that he creates his own data. You know, he's not making up data. But he's a very, very clever and prolific gravitational space biologist here at the University of California, San Diego, in the Department of Orthopedics. So great to have you here, Alan. Thank you. I can honestly say that I would not be even standing here today. I would not be an astronaut had it not been for the opportunity to work in Alan's lab and the things that followed from that experience. So thank you so much. So I've never done this before, but I'm going to start with a real downer. And I think it's important to do so. You know, in my life, Nepal has become a very central theme. It's a very special place on this planet. And unfortunately, the times have been very, very rough in this beautiful country that I know so well. I've spent about 4 to 5 months in country on the side of Mount Everest, struggling my way up with some amazing people. So I wanted to show you a brief video that I and a colleague took in 2009. This is not the avalanche that killed 17 people about 10 days ago, but it's very characteristic of things that we would see on a daily basis. And this is probably what it would have looked like seconds before the avalanche a few days ago. But it looks like a nuclear fallout cloud is going to come up and swallow you whole. And it's just a horrible tragedy that so many individuals, not just here on Everest, 17 people died a couple of weeks ago. 60 people were injured. Several hundred people were stranded above the Khumbu Icefall. But moreover, over 7,000 people perished in Nepal. It's a country of incredible beauty, but also unbelievable poverty. And so I just would like you to keep the people of Nepal in your thoughts or your prayers or whatever it is you happen to like to do when you think about those who are less fortunate than yourself. But if you're so motivated, this is a wonderful website. 100% of the proceeds that they receive go in country to help people that need it the most. So just wanted to put that in as I start my talk. Now we're going to elevate the mood and start with the rest of my talk. But this is your beautiful city. This is San Diego, 250 miles straight up, taken about 3 or 4 months ago. And obviously it's one of the most beautiful places on the planet. and I'm very thankful to be here with you. One of my overarching mantras in life is this quote right here, but all of us fortunate enough to be in healthcare have both an opportunity and an obligation to innovate. It's really not the way to go about delivery of healthcare by doing things the way that they've always been done without thinking about ways to make it better. I mean, if we hadn't challenged ourselves, we might still be using, you know, leeches and bloodletting as a treatment for everything that ails us. And of course, the way that we innovate, the way that we take things to the next level is to always question, is there a better way? Can we reduce pain? Can we improve outcomes? Can we make things more straightforward, simple for the surgeon or the nurse, what have you? But this is a theme that has been kind of central in my life. So this young whippersnapper here is me at age 5. My father was a rocket scientist on the Apollo program. I grew up with model rockets and posters on the wall. I remember one time my father invited to dinner one of Wernher von Braun's original German rocket scientists over for dinner. I don't remember much of what he said. He had a great, really cool German accent, and he talked about sending men to the moon. And I thought, wow, I want to be part of that. I want to set... In my mind, I had the vision of setting the first boot print down on Mars. Didn't quite work out that way for me, but I have no complaints. I had an amazing career, I think, in the space program. And so I'm going to take you through my pathway through life and kind of describe my approach to innovation and why I'm so excited about this day and age. This is an incredibly exciting time to be alive and to be a creative person in the healthcare space. So, you know, the things that I was always interested in as a kid all had to do with science and technology and exploration. My son thinks I'm a little bit of a geek, a little bit of a Star Trek nerd, but I'm okay with that, badge of honor. But the thing that I've taken from my steps through life is anything that's really, truly worth doing is going to take a lot of effort. It's not going to be handed to you. You're going to have to fight for it. It takes time, passion, dedication, and with action, you can achieve wonderful things. And so the folks that really inspired me growing up were explorers. These were scientists, technologists, physicians who put their skin in the game. They went to places that were beyond our imagination and opened up the world, opened up so many different frontiers. So Mallory and Irvine, Captain Jacques Cousteau, who is a huge boyhood hero of mine. In fact, I invited him to my very first shuttle launch, and lo and behold, he came. It was an extraordinary thing. I wrote him a letter about 6 months before the launch and thought that he would probably just throw this letter away. He probably gets, you know, hundreds of letters a day. But lo and behold, he came. And in addition to coming, he actually presented me with one of his red beanie caps to take with me up into space, which is really special, one of my prized possessions. And of course, Hillary and Tenzing Norgay on top of Everest in 1953, Lewis and Clark. Who can forget John Glenn, the first American to orbit the Earth, Sir Roger Bannister, and of course Yuri Gagarin, the first human being to orbit the Earth. So we need to, in our lives, think about who inspires us, where we want to go, and then see if there's a model that we can derive from studying their exploits. And that's kind of what I did. I was very fortunate in life to travel a lot, to meet lots of different people. I lived all over the world, actually, as a kid. And so these are some of the places that I lived, and some of them are probably not recognizable, but I lived in West Africa in Dakar, Senegal, when I was about 11 years old. In the lower right here, this is Beirut, Lebanon, right after the 1975 Civil War. We left a couple months before this, but thankfully this beautiful city has been rebuilt and is a place that we can now visit again. The upper right here is Tehran, which you may recognize. I was there in 1978. Right before the Shah was deposed. And it was an incredibly exciting place to be, but unfortunately it's a place in the world where we can't safely travel as Americans. But I hope that nations will come together and it'll be possible to visit that beautiful country again. And then the shaggy-haired kid in the center here, this is my basketball team in Athens, Greece, where I graduated from high school. So I think it's a common DNA between all of us as well. We have a relentless sense of curiosity, pushing boundaries, figuring out ways to do things better. And so I just wanted to take you on a really interesting expedition we took to the high Andes. This is La Concobar volcano. It's on the border of Bolivia and Chile. It's about 20,000 feet tall. And I was invited to this group of explorers to go study this environment. I was the only astronaut as part of this team. We're looking to environments like this as potentially a training base for future lunar and Mars explorers. So we wanted to have astronauts in the field doing field research. And so I went with a team of astrobiologists. These are folks that study life in the extreme. And they know that this is an environment that Mars must have been like about 3.5 billion years ago. So I was very excited to represent the office, astronaut office. I was, of course, a mountaineer and a physician. So I was there to support in that role. And we're going up to this summit caldera lake, which is the highest lake in the world. And they wanted, they were telling me in the briefing, the year before they had gone to this lake, they had taken this inflatable raft to nearly 20,000 feet, and some poor soul had to pump up this this raft. And then somebody had to row the rowboat out into the center of the lake, and they put a diver in the lake with a plumb bob, and they were measuring the depth of this lake at a handful of different locations to see whether or not over time the lake was growing or receding. And I thought to myself, well, maybe there's something that I can do. I'm coming at this. I'm not an expert in your field. I'm an orthogonal thinker to what you're doing. But I really believe in multidisciplinary approaches to solving problems. So I asked for a $500 budget. Let me see what I can do. I've got a couple maybe crazy ideas, but it's not going to cost you too much. Let me see what I can do. So I went out and I bought a toy boat, of course, a battery-operated boat, and I put a GPS receiver on top of it and a Lowrance fish finder in the front of it. You can see a little prow on the front of this contraption. And I took it up to the top of this mountain. I drove a toy boat across the lake, back and forth, back and forth. And why did I do that? To create this incredibly accurate, high-resolution, very spatially detailed bathymetric map of the summit caldera lake. So it's just an example of, you know, the importance of bringing together teams that don't always look like we do, don't come from the same backgrounds, don't have the same thought processes. You can come up with really unique, interesting solutions to problems. Another thing that I wanted to talk about is perseverance. And so, you know, I've had a number of high, lofty goals in life. Not all of them have worked out. And I'm sure you can relate to these that kind of theme as well. So I, very young in life, I was a fairly athletic guy. I ran track. And I was recruited to a crazy sport called luge. And it's done on a very steep ice track and incredible adrenaline. And I was doing this as part of my medical school years. I spent about half of the year in medical school in my clerkships, half of the year with the U.S. luge team. And I was competing for the Calgary Olympics in 1988. And so I didn't quite make the U.S. Olympic squad. And I was pretty disappointed by this, but opportunity knocked. And a friend of mine, Ray Ocampo, who was representing the Philippines, decided that he needed a coach. And who did he tap? His good friend, Scott Parazynski. And so I ended up marching in the opening ceremonies of the Calgary Games. I had lived in the Olympic Village. We were the tiniest delegation in the entire Olympics. It was amazing. When we walked in, we were obviously the underdog, but the entire section would get up and do the wave as we marched in. And it was, yeah, as a young kid, it was great. I got to meet Eddie the Eagle and the Jamaican bobsled team, and I ogled Katarina Vitt and all those kinds of things that young guys do. Another theme that I think is relatable to all of our walks of life is adversity is going to happen, and it's how we handle adversity that determines our overall course in life. And so the roughest thing that I've ever faced in my life, bar none, was the loss of the STS-107 Columbia crew. I was very close to this entire crew. It's not like there are a whole lot of astronauts in the world, but this crew in particular, it was very close. I was actually a family escort for this crew for the launch of the mission. I was with their families on the rooftop as the shuttle took off. I was there with them during the mission, the 16-day flawless flight that they had executed. And unfortunately, 16 minutes prior to landing over the skies of Texas, we lost this fine crew and the vehicle. And it was a really devastating blow, not only to the astronaut corps, but all of NASA and our nation, as you know. And of course, it was an international mission. Ilan Ramon on the far right, Israeli fighter pilot and war hero. He was lost as well, and that nation mourned. And so it was a deciding point for me. Should I hang up my spacesuit, or should I steel my resolve and figure out what happened and get us back safely to flight and to fly again? And that's, of course, what all of us did. It was a very difficult time, but also one of the most creative periods of my life as well. We invented dozens of new technologies, invented new materials to solve really complex problems. The shuttle was never meant to be visited on the underside. There are no handrails. There's no way for a spacewalker to get there. So we invented a way to get there. We had to invent a really crazy inspection boom that allowed a spacewalker. This is actually me on sort of an air hockey table. I'm on a sled, and below this sled are air jets that are jetting down on a very smooth stainless steel surface. So that in this plane, I'm actually feeling the same dynamics as I would in weightlessness. We also, up in the upper right corner here, developed all these different techniques to repair tile should the space shuttle sustain major damage as it did on Columbia. So we did get back to flight, thankfully, and an incredible team effort. And Maynard has made a number of powerful statements along these lines, but it's certainly at NASA, this is part of our makeup. We have to do things as a team. This is a very complex, unforgiving environment. And so the crews that you see here that I was very fortunate to fly with, we represent thousands of people. It's not just the crew that's here. It's the flight directors and the flight controllers, the engineers, the scientists, the technicians that prepared our vehicles and the experiments that we would fly to make it safe and for us to bring back the science and things that we were set out to do. So I'm just going to run through very quickly the five missions that I flew. This was my first mission aboard Shuttle Atlantis in November of 1994, and we went up to study the Earth's ozone layer, basically the sunglasses of the Earth that protect all of our plant life, prevent us from getting skin cancer, at least limit our exposure to skin cancer. It doesn't entirely prevent us, so please use your sunscreen. But these were sensitive instruments that we flew in space to study the Earth's ozone layer as well as the Antarctic ozone hole. And then a couple of years later, I flew up to the Russian space station Mir and did a very exciting spacewalk with a Russian cosmonaut. And then probably the greatest honor of my career was getting a chance to fly with Senator John Glenn. He was invited back. Actually, he lobbied him very successfully to get back into the cockpit to fly one final mission at age 77. And as a physician, I was assigned as his personal physician, which is pretty high threat environment. If something happened to John, I might as well not come back home. I might as well take a spacewalk without a spacesuit. This is very, very serious business here. But thankfully, he's a hard as nails Marine, still in great shape, and so even to this day. And so he did extremely well in the mission. But he was also a guinea pig on this flight. So he was assigned to this flight to help us understand the differences between the adaptation a younger astronaut has to space and a much more senior statesman, and really contributed greatly to our research. But he really hated needles, and unfortunately a lot of medical research requires lots of blood work, and so he was kind of a wimp when it came to needles, and so he called me Count Parazinskila or Dracula. So of course my only response was to fly some Dracula fangs up there with me to spook him a little bit. He was a good sport. And then I had the opportunity to go up to the International Space Station and install the robotic arm to the International Space Station with astronaut Chris Hadfield, a name that may ring a bell with some of you. He did a beautiful rendition of David Bowie's Space Oddity. Maybe some of you have seen that, but if you haven't, you should Google it. It's wonderful. And then the mission that I want to spend the most time discussing with you here today is my final flight into space, STS-120. To the International Space Station. Your spaceflight crew becomes an extended family. And it's not just the crew, but it's the training team and the flight control team around us. But this is us on Christmas morning, basically. We're about to go out to the launch pad. I had a wonderful crew. Our commander is in the upper right here. Her name is Pam Melroy. She became only the second female to command a space shuttle mission. Great leader. And all the rest of the crew that I'll hopefully get a chance to introduce through the course of this. But here we are on launch morning in our orange pumpkin suits, walking out to the Astrovan, which is basically a fancy motorhome with some cooling units in it. And wave to all the folks that had prepared our shuttle for us. And then we would take a 3.5-mile ride out to the launch pad, which is really an exciting day to see it there on the launch pad. It's alive. It's venting beneath, and you realize that you're about to leave the planet. Break the surly bonds of Earth and go into space, which is just extraordinary. We're, of course, on our backs because that's the direction of travel we're headed. And it takes about 2.5 hours to get prepped and to make sure that there's no leak in the cabin. And then 6 seconds before the main engines will ignite, and if computers on board sense that they're all working properly, T0, the white solid rocket boosters will ignite, and then you're off to the races. I mean, you're clearing the launch tower, and you're already going 100 miles an hour. 3 Gs through your chest, a lot of squeeze taking a deep inspiration is quite difficult. We sort of roll gracefully onto our back, and I remember actually looking out the overhead windows using a mirror, and I could actually see waves crashing on the beach. It was kind of surreal, actually. And you can see our bobbleheads moving along there as we get ready for first stage when the white solid rocket boosters will separate. And it's kind of spooky to see these bright lights out the front windows there, realizing that those are actually rocket engines firing directly at you. But they have it all figured out, and those white solid rocket boosters will fall into the ocean underneath parachutes and be recycled. And then we continue on up for another 6.5 minutes to orbital velocity, which is 17,500 miles an hour. So you're really humming along, 5 miles a second over the Earth's surface as you look straight down. This is our space shuttle as we're approaching the International Space Station. We have a very special payload here in the center. This is the Harmony node. It's an interconnecting node that will allow us to basically install European and Japanese modules in the near future. And so we approach the International Space Station, which looks like this, kind of like a Star Wars TIE fighter, if any of you know what that means. And this is one of our major objectives here. This is the P6 Solar Array Truss. Not a catchy name, but it's actually a very important part of the space station. These are actually solar panels that are retracted. They would look very much like this, but the solar panels have already been retracted. We're going to disconnect it here using spacewalkers, myself and Doug Wheelock, and then via robotic arm, move it all the way out here to the very tip, and then extend these huge solar wings that are about 100 feet in length. Very complex interaction between mission control, the spacewalkers, and the robotics folks inside. And so the mission had been going incredibly well. We had done 3 perfect spacewalks. We're all grins. Doug Wheelock and I floated into the airlock, and you know, we couldn't believe how flawlessly things had gone thus far. But lo and behold, as we floated into the lab of the space station, everyone was really down. We couldn't understand it until we saw this through the CCTV cameras. This is one of our solar panels, which is gold and shiny and kind of pretty. But this is an astronaut's worst nightmare, because this is a live solar panel that's been ripped apart. It has sharp edges, of course, to it, and it's not fully extended. So this is basically a limp noodle in space that we would either have to go out and repair via spacewalking or throw away a $1 billion national asset. And so true to NASA form, NASA took something that's incredibly, impossibly difficult and made it look easy. They spent the next 72 hours working around the clock, lots of caffeine involved, to come up with this solution. This is George Zamka, our pilot on the mission, a Marine as well. And he had fabricated in one of our laboratories what we call the cufflink. So this is a wire that's about 5 feet in length, wrapped up. This is a tether loop, so I don't drop it in space. You don't want to drop anything, because if you aren't tethered to it, it's gone in 5 seconds. And here at the very tip of these lengths of wire were 2 tabs that we would actually use to stabilize the solar panel as it unfurled. So I'll show you that here in a minute. But just a brilliant solution. We had to treat this as almost an Apollo 13 event. We had to dump out everything that we had on board the space shuttle and space station. What can we make with the stuff we have available to us? We couldn't go to Home Depot. That was not an option. So, nor was failure. Failure was not an option either. And so here's Stephanie and Stephanie Wilson and Dan Tani, who were the robotics folks that would fly me out to the very tip of the station. And I'll take you out on this ride with me. This is the helmet camera that I had on my spacesuit, and this is the God's eye view that I had looking down on the space station. Here I am at the end of a 90-foot-long robotic boom. It took 45 minutes, just one way, to get to the work site, further away than we'd ever been from the safety of our airlock. And here's the damage site, the target that we're going to go do surgery on. And kind of tricky stuff, because this is a solar panel that we couldn't turn off. Even in on the backside of the Earth in darkness, it's still generating energy. So there's still a very high risk of electrocution should there be any metal-to-metal contact with the solar panel in my suit. So I had to keep a safe distance from it while still working very, very delicately with the panel. And I had to slip the cuff link through the hole in the solar panel there to essentially create the load path that would allow us to fully extend the solar panel. And it worked extremely well. It was a brilliant plan, and thankfully I didn't screw up my part. I was at the very end of the sequence, but just a real high point for the space shuttle space station era. We put in 5 of these across the breadth of the solar panel and then fully extended this solar array, and now it's up there generating 100% of the power that it was established for, and we're able to then launch those European and Japanese modules that I mentioned. So a really great accomplishment for the nation. So here's one parting shot from the worksite. And after we had completed our job, we undocked from the space station and did a full lap. We call it a fly around. And fortuitously, we're actually flying over the Himalayas. And so this is a nice segue for the next segment of my talk. But here you can actually see where Doug and I had been working a couple of days earlier and the beautiful planet below. On my very first trip into space, I took this photograph, and this is actually the summit of the world's highest mountain, Mount Everest. And it's really an amazing experience to look at your home planet from this rarefied perspective. You can kind of have these mental transformations, imagining yourself transported down there, kind of Star Trek-like. And I just wondered what it would be like to actually stand on this point of our planet. And being a longtime rock climber and mountaineer, at this point I set my sights on one day figuring out a way somehow to get there. And I'm going to take you there. It wasn't an easy path, but the take-home lesson from this is it's not about making a one-way trip. There are a lot of folks, unfortunately, who have made one-way trips to the top of Mount Everest, but it doesn't really count unless you come back home and you can tell people about it. So... it's also a great opportunity to innovate. And so one of the things that I did is I read everything that I possibly could about Mount Everest. Anyone ever read Into Thin Air by John Krakauer? A lot of hands. It's one of the most wonderful books you will ever come across. Even if you have no interest in mountaineering, it's a book about competition. It's about leadership, failed leadership, judgment, poor judgment. And so I used Into Thin Air as my guidebook of what not to do on Mount Everest. And so one of the things that I took from all my readings is that a lot of mountaineers would get to the summits of great mountains, and they would have 3 liters of ice in their backpack. Even though they were in thermoses and very well-insulated devices, they really weren't set for the task. And so when you really need to be hydrated and well-nourished is on the descent, that's when most people will perish. And so I decided that I was going to fix that, and so invented... a container, a Camelback in essence, but it had a very special drink straw with a closed feedback loop heater tape such that there would never be a chance of ice formation in the drink straw. And so this is available for license in case anyone's interested. I always like to put in a plug for that. But Everest is just an extraordinary place. This is deep inside the Khumbu Icefall, crossing a crevasse. Sometimes these crevasses could be 150 or 200 feet deep. Really beautiful, but also incredibly perilous. So we don't like to linger, of course, in the Khumbu Icefall. And I've been climbing extremely well. This is the 2008 season on Mount Everest, my first attempt on Everest. I'm at Camp 3 here at 24,500 feet above sea level. And I don't know if you can see the bloodshot in my eyes, but I have not slept a wink, not even 30 seconds this past night. I had developed excruciating low back pain that I didn't know the source of, but I knew that I was really in a bad way, and I hoped that the following morning I would wake up and I'd be able to continue on my summit push, because it was basically 24 hours to the summit from this location. And I even had to have help from my teammates just to put on my crampons, the spikes in my boots, to take the next steps up higher on the mountain and to change my oxygen cylinder. So this was not going well for me. And I realized that if I were to press on from this point, I would not only jeopardize my own life, but maybe the summit success of my teammates, maybe even putting them in a life or death situation. So this was a defining moment in my life, but I realized that the only thing that I could do from this point was descend. I'm also a very optimistic person, so I like to say, at least on the bright side, I had an unlimited supply of ice. And so every 20 or 30 minutes or so, I would lay down on the ice during my descent. And this is my buddy Bob Lowry, who descended with me because he had run out of steam as well. and we would ice my back down, and then I would continue to hobble on down to base camp. This is what I looked like actually at Camp 2, halfway down the mountain. I spent a night here at Camp 2, and the following morning I was about to descend all the way to base camp and figure out a way to get home. But I got a house call at about 3:30 in the morning, I guess it was. And my buddy Monty here had an incredible nosebleed, bilateral nosebleed. He had lost at least 20% of his blood volume. So I had to make a house call, crippled, to save his life in the middle of the night. But we're able to get the nosebleed stopped. And then poor Monty and I kind of hobbled down to Everest Base Camp. And thankfully, as his personal physician, I was able to join him on his medevac helicopter, because it would have been a long hike for me with a crippled back, because I was still in a lot of pain. Now, it's a very rare opportunity to get a chance to moon your audience in public speaking, but I found myself on the operating room table as soon as I got home. This is Methodist Hospital in Houston, Texas. I think to be proper here, to anonymize this photo, I should anonymize the anesthesiologist as well, but I ended up having a microdiscectomy. I had a ruptured disc in my low back. And within 2 hours of this operation, I was up and walking. And within 2 months, I was back in the gym and ready to give it another shot. And so the next season, I was able to return to Mount Everest. This is my buddy, Danuru Sherpa from Fortse, who I summited with. And just on a beautiful acclimatization trek above Everest Base Camp here. This is the summit of Mount Everest with about 100-mile-an-hour winds today. Lhotse, which is the fourth highest mountain in the world, and Nupsi, which is a very scary mountain here to the right, about 7,800 meters. This is the dreaded Khumbu Icefall, and it's really a river of snow and ice, and it's very dynamic. Every day it's moving about 3 feet. And so our goal always was to get up very early, get up and beyond the icefall here to Camp 1 at about 19,500 feet before the sun would hit. And so just a little story about Danuru, because he's such an amazing human being, but he's now summited 16 times. And I would always joke with him that he had 3 lungs and 2 hearts. He was always cheating. But thankfully, on summit day, he was every bit as knocked out as I was. But just a great spirit that he had. Here we are deep in the Khumbu Icefall, climbing some seracs. And very accelerated now. It takes about 2 months, actually, to allow your body to acclimatize to the thinning air. You have to build extra red blood cells in your circulation such that you can make a go at the summit. And so I've done extremely well here, and I'm now at Camp 4. This is the highest encampment in the world. It's 26,000 feet or 8,000 meters above sea level. It's kind of the beginning of what we call the death zone, which is a dramatic term, but it's fairly apt, because the human body really cannot sustain itself here. You can't consume enough calories, you can't drink enough fluid to stay alive here for very long. So we're just transients here. And so I don't think there are any media here, so I'll tell this little joke. Well, it is on camera, but it's just a joke, believe me. So this is a site where NASA faked its lunar landings. So this is a place that is really the most windswept, desolate place on Earth. In the wintertime here, you can actually see a bunch of old tent remains. You probably get 200-mile-an-hour winds and temperatures well below anything that a human being could withstand. So just an incredibly desolate, desperate place. Thankfully, the weather was beautiful here. This is probably about minus 15 or so on a sunny day. And we had wonderful weather for our summit push. So what we're planning to do here is through the middle of the night, we'll cross this plateau. Lhotse is over here on the right, and we'll cross the plateau up the triangular face of Everest to the ridgeline, to the balcony here, and climb up to the south summit, and then drop down a little bit. We'll cross a Cornice Ridge and then meet the Hillary Step that you may have heard about, and then up to the summit at 29,035 feet above sea level. All through the night, we want to arrive fairly early in the morning such that we can be back down before the afternoon storms arrive. And again, this is all driven by Into Thin Air and all the other books that I've read. I wanted to be ahead of the crowd. I wanted to be in the lead for the entire morning. And so there were about 30 climbers that were clamoring to summit this day. I heard them getting up at around 8 o'clock at night. My goal had been actually to leave this camp at around 11 at night. But since I heard other people getting ready to go, I quickly got my gear on and got out in front of everybody, and we led the mountain that day. And this is what the summit shadow of Mount Everest looks like nearing the summit. Actually, this has taken on our descent. But if you've ever wondered what it looks like to actually arrive on the summit of Mount Everest, this is video shot as a result of being on a TV show called Everest Beyond the Limit. I was the team physician in the third series of that, third season of that episode, that show. And here I am coming up and plopping myself down on the summit. That's pretty much all you really want to do when you finally get there. And you can see some beautiful multicolored Tibetan prayer flags there on the summit as well. There's also a really beautiful gold Buddha on top of the mountain as well, right back there. You can hear the crunching snow. Very special experience in my life. You know, I think the things that come hardest to us end up meaning the most to us. You know, if I had summited the very first go at this, it might not have meant quite as much. But the fact that I had to struggle back and return the second year, this is, you know, one of the biggest moments of my life to actually get up there. And so one of the special tributes that I wanted to make was to honor a couple of my other boyhood heroes. Sir Edmund Hillary, for one. I've already spoken of him. But Neil Armstrong. And this very special rock here is from the moon, which you can see here. Dunoor nailed this photo. It's really a beautiful shot. This is actually a sample collected on the Sea of Tranquility by Neil Armstrong in July of 1969. And my goal was to actually arrive on the summit of Mount Everest and give Neil a call on my satellite phone, but your fingers get really very, very cold up there. And those buttons on satellite phones are very, very tiny, so I wasn't able to get through to Neil. But I did bring a summit rock back down, and this is the lunar sample that I had borrowed from NASA, mounted on a plaque, and it's now aboard the International Space Station in a module called Tranquility to inspire future generations of explorers. And another quick story that I'd share is that this little moon sample here was the reason I met my wife. And you can ask me after the talk how that happened, but very special to me. So I'm going to kind of wrap up here, wrap up Everest here at least, with a joke that I think is really, really funny. Mountaineers love this joke. You may or may not get it, but the joke is, on your way down from the summit of Mount Everest, whatever you do, don't fall to the right. If you fall to the right, it's 8,000 feet straight down. If you fall to the left, it's 10,000 feet straight down, and you live a little bit longer. But another just quick element of my life, in recent years, I've been responsible for overseeing healthcare in Antarctica for the United States Antarctic Program and the National Science Foundation. And so it's an incredibly powerful analog environment for, obviously, space exploration, but also remote medical care and pressing the boundaries of telemedicine. And so I've had some great discussions with Sanjeev and the ECHO team. But you know, it's a very powerful environment for technology development, as well as point-of-care solutions, diagnostics and therapeutic solutions. By law, I'm required every time I talk about Antarctica to show a cute and cuddly picture of penguins. So, but here's an example of our telemedicine operations at UTMB, where I very recently worked. We have telemedicine consoles where we could actually telementor the delivery of anesthesia. We could actually coach people through the performance of an echocardiogram or transvaginal ultrasound. Whatever we needed to do that wasn't in the skill set of the providers that we sent down there, we could coach them through it. So a very successful program. So what does the future hold? At least in my life, I'll share a few things. The things that really motivate me. This is my daughter, Jenna. She's a wonderful little girl. She's 15 years old. And she's kind of revectored my life. She's autistic, but a very bright and engaging girl, loves to sing and dance and loves computers. So I've learned a lot from her. And in fact, it kind of shaped my thinking for the Ascend Institute that I'm going to introduce to you in a moment. But those with disabilities oftentimes have unique coping strategies that we could all benefit from. Not only do we need to help individuals with autism or other disabilities, but sometimes we can actually learn things that would benefit the average Joes and Janes, the rest of us. Because she, in our family, can very quickly program any computer game, any new gaming console, whatever it is. She's the tech guru in our household. But I did want to introduce the Ascend Institute that I'm forming at the Arizona State University. And I wanted to just kind of describe to you the boundary layer of human performance, if I might. I'll just take a couple of seconds here, but this is an artist's rendition of The Big Bang, by the way. I just like it. I think it's a beautiful rendition of three-dimensional space, rapid expansion of the universe. But you know, at the boundary of human performance, it's a multidimensional space. We have strength, we have vertical leap, we have athleticism, we have cognitive ability. Arguably, Michael Jordan is the greatest basketball player of all time. Certainly, my favorite athlete of all time. But also had the opportunity to go to medical school with Eric Heiden here, 5-time gold medal speed skater. But there are other special people that have done incredible things with the gifts that they, the cards that they were dealt. So this is Anthony Robles of ASU, NCAA wrestling champion with one leg. How does someone do that? I think that's just really remarkable. This is Temple Grandin, who you may have heard of, a remarkable woman, autistic woman who's an amazing inventor in the animal husbandry business. She's found coping strategies to allow her to be a very powerful member of society and changed her industry. A couple others that I'll show you. Professor Stephen Hawking, one of my idols, just an amazing mind. If people had not applied their mind power to figure out ways to allow him to extend his life, he probably had a 2-year life expectancy after diagnosis, and he's far exceeded that, and he's basically rewritten our understanding of astrophysics. And of course, it's not just the physical pursuits, but obviously artistic, creative pursuits. Ken Jennings, everyone knows from Jeopardy. I'm not sure he's the smartest man alive, but he's certainly an icon that we can relate to. But our boundaries in performance, the outliers of our society, span a lot of different disciplines. And also the resilience of Navy SEALs. This is a good friend of mine, Jay Redman, who sustained basically mortal wounds in Iraq and has come back and done extraordinary things for his fellow wounded warriors. And so what can we learn from people that are at the boundaries of our human existence? I think we can learn a lot. And so our goal with the Ascend Institute at Arizona State University is to quantify elite performance from the molecule to the man, or the proteome to the person is probably a better way to say that. Not just in the traditional sectors of performance, but also to look at those with disabilities who have come up with special adaptations. One really interesting character is this guy right down here. This is Eric Weyenmeyer, who summited Mount Everest completely blind, which I think is extraordinary. I know how hard Everest is, and to do it blind is just mind-boggling to me. But what did he do? He developed echolocation. And so could you and I learn how to echolocate? Absolutely. And so are there lessons that we can take from special adaptations that others have developed to cross-pollinate and make our lives better? And so this is the basic principle of the Ascend Institute. We want to raise human potential. And I think anyone with the drive and desires coupled with the right coaching and technology can improve their state in life. So we want to focus on persons with intellectual and physical disabilities, as well as those with elite exceptional abilities, and then all the average Joes and Janes in between. We want to elevate, not just level, the playing field for all human abilities and ages. So this is my next mission in life, and I thought I'd share it with you. And so I just wanted to thank you so much, Alex and the Cavendish Group, for having me back, and wanted to put this website up here as well. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.